Breaking the seals on the doorway was a momentous act, and despite the fact that the time before the onset of the rains was fast running out, neither of them was prepared to undertake it lightly. They had to make every effort to keep permanent records of everything they discovered, and to inflict as little damage as possible while gaining access. They spent one of their precious remaining days preparing for the break-in to the tomb. Naturally, Nicholas's first concern was the security of the tomb area. He asked McNamara to place an armed guard on the causeway over the sinkhole in the approach tunnel, and access beyond this point was restricted. Only Nicholas, Royan, Sapper, Mech, Tessé, and four of the monks whom Nicholas had selected were allowed across the bridge. Hansith Sheriff had proved himself repeatedly during the clearing of the lower tunnel. Physically strong, willing, and intelligent, he had become Nicholas's principal assistant. It was Hansith who carried the tripod and spare camera equipment, while Nicholas photographed the approach tunnel and the sealed doorway. He shot three rolls of high-speed film to make certain that they had a complete record of the unbroken seals and the doorway surrounds. Only when the filming was completed would Nicholas allow Hansith and the other three monks to bring up the tools needed for the break-in. Sapper moved the Honda generator up as far as the sinkhole to reduce the voltage drop over the distance that the current had to travel down the cable. Then he set up the floodlights on the upper landing of the staircase and focused them on the white expanse of the plastered doorway. When they had assembled at the threshold, they were all in a sober mood. Despite the fact that the tomb was thousands of years old, it was still an act of desecration that they were about to perpetrate. Royan had translated the hieroglyphic warning on the sealed doorway to Sapper, Mech, and Tessé, and none of them was prepared to take it lightly. Nicholas marked out the square opening he intended cutting through the plaster covering. This was large enough to afford access, but it also enclosed the royal cartouche and Tatia's maimed hawk seal. He intended lifting these out in one piece and preserving them intact. In his imagination, he could already see them displayed in a prominent position in the museum at Quentin Park. Nicholas began on the right-hand upper corner of the opening. First, he used a long, needle-sharp awl as a probe. He pressed and twisted the needle point through the dried clay in an attempt to determine exactly what lay beneath the surface. Very soon, he found out that the plaster had been laid over laths of finely interwoven reeds. "That makes it a lot easier," he told Royan. "The reed mat will help to hold the plaster together and prevent it cracking and breaking up." He kept working the point of the awl deeper, until suddenly the resistance gave way and the blade ran in its full length. 6 inches, he said, measuring the thickness of the door off the blade. "Taita never skimps, does he? It's a heavy bit of work." Still using the awl, Nicholas drilled all four corners of the square opening he intended cutting. Then he stepped back and gestured for Hansith to bring up the heavy 4-inch gimlet to enlarge them. This was the type of drill that fishermen use for cutting through lake ice in the winter. As soon as the gimlet broke through, Nicholas impatiently pulled Hansith aside and peered into the hole. Beyond the opening, all was completely dark. But he caught a whiff of the faint breath of ancient air that washed through the opening. The odour was dry and dead and austere, the smell of the ages long past. "What do you see?" Royan demanded at his elbow. "The light. Give me the light," he ordered. And when Sapper handed it to him, he held it to the opening. "Tell me," Royan was dancing beside him with impatience. "What do you see?" "Colours," he whispered. "The most marvellous, indescribable colours." He stepped back, and lifting her around the waist, held her so that she could look into the aperture. "Beautiful," she cried. "It's so beautiful." Sapper rigged up the heavy-duty electric blower fan, which would circulate the air in the shaft, while Nicholas prepared the chainsaw. When he was ready, Nicholas handed Royan a pair of goggles and a dust mask and helped her to adjust them. Then he made her fit a pair of wax earplugs. Before he started the chainsaw, he sent the rest of them back down the tunnel as far as the causeway over the sinkhole. In the confined space, the exhaust fumes from the chainsaw and the dust, together with the noise of the petrol engine, would be overpowering. But apart from that, he wanted only Rayanne with him at the moment of the break-in. When they were alone, Nicholas switched the blower fan to its highest speed, then donned his own mask and goggles and plugged his ears. He pulled the starter cord of the chainsaw motor, and it burst into life in a cloud of blue exhaust smoke. He braced himself and pressed the spinning chain blade into the gimlet hole in the plastered doorway. It cut through the thick white plaster and the laths beneath it, like a knife through the icing on a wedding cake. Carefully, he ran the cutting edge down the line he had marked out. A cloud of flying white plaster dust filled the air. Within seconds, they could see only a few feet in front of their eyes. Doggedly, Nicholas kept the cut going, down the right-hand side, across the bottom, then up the left side. Finally, he made the last cut across the top. And when the square trapdoor began to sag forward under its own weight, he killed the engine of the chainsaw and set it aside. Rayanne jumped forward to help him, and together in the eddies of dust and smoke they steadied the square of plaster and prevented it from crashing to the paving and shattering into a thousand pieces. Gently they lifted it out of the opening, and with the seal still intact, laid it against the sidewall of the landing. The open hatchway they had cut through the plaster was a dark square. Nicholas adjusted the floodlight to shine through it, but the dust was still too dense for them to be able to see much of the interior. He climbed through the hatch into the space beyond. All was obscured by a dense fog of dust that not even the lamps could penetrate. He did not attempt to explore further, but immediately turned back to help Rayanne through the opening after him. He recognized her right to share every moment of this discovery. Beyond the wall, they stood quietly together, waiting for the blower fan to clear the air. Slowly, the dust fog began to dissipate, and the first thing they became aware of was the floor beneath their feet. No longer made of stone slabs, it was covered with tiles of yellow agate that had been polished to a gloss and fitted together so cunningly that no joints were visible. It was like a single sheet of lovely opaque glass, dulled only by the film of fine talcum dust that had settled upon it. Where their feet had disturbed the layer of dust, the agate sparkled through it, catching the light of the flood lamp. Then the fog of dust that surrounded them thinned, and gradually a miraculous blaze of colours and shapes began to appear through the murk. Rayanne lifted the dust mask from her face and let it drop to the agate floor. Nicholas followed her example and took a breath of stagnant air. No draught had disturbed it for thousands of years, and it had the odour of great antiquity, the musty smell of the linen bandages of an embalmed corpse. Now the miasma of dust faded away, and before them opened a long, straight passageway, the end of which was hidden in shadow and darkness. Nicholas turned back to the opening in the sealed door behind them and reached through it to bring in the floodlight on its stand. Quickly he arranged it to illuminate the full length of the passageway ahead of them. As they started forward, the images of the old gods hovered around them. They glowered at the intruders from the walls and hung over them, watching them with huge and hostile eyes from the ceiling high overhead. Nicholas and Rayanne passed on slowly. Their footfalls on the agate tiles were muted by the thin carpet of dust, and the dust that still hung in the air reflected the light and cast over them a luminous net that had an ethereal dreamlike quality. Inscriptions covered every inch of space upon the walls and the high roof. There were long quotations from all the mystical writings, from the Book of Breathings, the Book of the Pylons, and the Book of Wisdom. Other blocks of hieroglyphics recited the history of Pharaoh Mamose's existence on this earth and extolled those virtues that made the gods love him. Further along they came to the first of 8 shrines set into the walls of the long funeral gallery. This one was the shrine of Osiris. It was a circular chamber, the curved wall decorated with texts in praise of the god, and in its niche a small statue of Osiris in his tall feathered headdress, with eyes of onyx and rock crystal which stared at them so implacably that Rayanne shivered. Nicholas reached out and touched the foot of the god. He said one word, gold. Then he looked up at the towering mural that covered the wall and half the domed ceiling above and around the shrine. It was another gigantic figure of the father Osiris, god of the underworld, with its green face and false beard, his arms crossed upon his chest, holding the flail and the crook, wearing his tall feathered headdress, and with the erect cobra on his brow. They gazed up at him with a sense of awe. As the lamplight wavered in the shifting dust cloud, the god seemed to become imbued with life, and to move and sway before their eyes. They did not linger at the first shrine, for beyond it the gallery ran on, straight as the flight of an arrow to its target. They followed it. The next shrine set into the wall was dedicated to the goddess. The golden figure of Isis sat in her niche, upon the throne that was her symbol. The infant Horus suckled at her breast. Her eyes were ivory and blue lapis lazuli. Her murals covered the walls around her niche. There she was, the mother with great coal-lined eyes as black as night, wearing the sun disk and the horns of the sacred cow upon her head. All around her, hieroglyphic symbols covered the wall, so bright that they glowed like a cloud of fireflies. For she possessed 100 diverse names. Amongst these were Ast and Net and Bast. She was also Ptah and Seka and Mesakut and Renu. Each of these names was a word of power, for her sanctity and her benevolent aura had lived on where most of the old gods had withered away for lack of worshippers to repeat and keep alive these mystic names. In ancient Byzantium and later in Christian Egypt, they had bestowed the old goddess's virtues and attributes upon the Virgin Mary. The image of her suckling the infant Horus had been perpetuated in the icons of the Madonna and Child. Thus Royan responded to the goddess in all her entities, the mingled blood of Royan's forefathers in her veins, acknowledging both Isis and Mary, heresy and truth mingling inextricably in her heart, so that she felt at once both guilt and religious elation. In the next shrine was a golden figure of Horus, the falcon-headed, the last of the Holy Trinity. In his right hand he held the war bow, and in his left the ankh, for life and death were his to dispense. His eyes were red carnelians. Portraits of his other entities surrounded the statue. Horus the infant, suckling at the breast of Isis. Horus as the divine youth, Harpocrates, proud and lithe and beautiful. One finger touching his chin in the ritual gesture, striding out on sandaled feet under his short, stiff kilt. Then Horus the falcon-headed, sometimes with the body of a lion and then with the body of a young warrior, wearing the great crown of the south and the north united. Beneath him was the inscription, "Great God and Lord of Heaven, of manifest power, mighty one amongst all the gods, whose strength has vanquished the foes of his divine father, Osiris." In the fourth shrine stood Seth, the arch-fiend, the god of violence and discord. His body was gold, but his head was the head of a black hyena. In the fifth shrine stood the god of the dead and of the cemeteries, Anubis, the jackal-headed. It was he who officiated at the embalming, and whose duty it was to examine the tongue of the great balance when the heart of the deceased was weighed. If the beam of the scales were exactly horizontal, then the dead man was declared worthy. But if the balance tipped against him, Anubis threw the heart to the crocodile monster, and it was devoured.